I believe that a concentration of believers has made America a strong, noble country. As I got older and learned more about history, I saw how the founding fathers used Judeo-Christian philosophy to forge the Constitution, perhaps the most perspicacious political document ever designed. I also understood how a strong belief in good over evil enabled the USA to defeat godless enemies like Nazi Germany, the Japanese emperor, who was regarded himself as a god, and the Soviet Union. Yes, there have been bad things done under the banner of religion in America, no doubt. But on balance, the United States has benefited greatly by the mass belief Americans hold in a just, compassionate God. As I wrote in Culture Warrior, I never had a problem believing in a higher power because of nature. It works. There's never a miscommunication. Everything man gets involved with is fraught with uncertainty. But every morning, the sun comes up. Now, some think an asteroid or something caused the natural order. Wow, talk about blind faith. So combining a good guy like Jesus with a higher power that created a stunningly efficient natural universe was relatively easy for a simple guy like me. There was no major downside to being Catholic, except, of course, the inconvenience of actually obeying the rules. There's always a catch. There's no doubt that many people who attended Catholic schools see things differently than I do. Some say the experience damaged them, and I respect their dissent, as every school situation is unique. I also respect every other religion that promotes goodwill toward all people. In my view of life, spirituality is a very positive thing, and faith is a personal matter that should be accepted as such. If somebody tells me I'm going to hell because I don't believe as they do, I simply put three letters next to their name. N-U-T. One of the blessings that I was given, not by an asteroid, is the ability to think for myself. So all the while I was going through St. Bridget's School, I was doing that. I absorbed the lessons, challenged them often, and ultimately decided that the faith I was born into was the one I would die with. My call, and I'm glad I made it. Along the way, there were certainly times when I could have chucked the Catholic way of life. Some of my friends did. But I hung in there despite some tension between the church establishment and me. As mentioned, many of my teachers marked me as a very bad influence, a troubled and wayward youth. I know you may find that hard to believe. In the fourth grade, for example, our teacher Amy Martin, a Catholic layperson, put me in the dumb row where I most assuredly belonged. Located closest to the windows, this row of desks was reserved for students who were not exactly lighting it up academically, if you know what I mean. Immediately, I was smart enough to figure out how foolish it was to locate the dumb row by the windows. Question, what do dumb kids often like to do during class? Why, look out the window, of course. Pretty dumb of you, Mrs. Martin, I must say. Unlike some in the dumb row, I had no self-esteem issues about being there. In fact, it was fun. Clement was a dumb row denizen, and a couple of my other friends were too. So, instead of being ashamed, I pulled a Tom Sawyer and convinced the class that the hippest kids inhabited the dumb row. My spin went like this. Mrs. Martin was clueless, unanimous agreement, and Clement was the coolest kid in town. Do the math. Tough for dumb rowers. The window row was the place to be. Before long, Mrs. Martin got wind that the dumb row assignation was no longer a humiliation, but had somehow evolved into a status symbol. Furious, she upped the ante, hoping to further humiliate us by constantly berating the row. However, the more she ranted, the more prestigious the row became. It was anarchy in the finest sense. Clement and I celebrated this unlikely success by upping the ante ourselves and openly mocking Mrs. Martin. Looking back, that was wrong, probably a venial sin. But the teacher did deserve some of the grief we gave her, no question. More important, the fourth grade was a crucial turning point in all our lives. From that time on, it was guerrilla warfare between my classmates and our teachers all the way through to the eighth grade. We had thousands of laughs. The insurrection was permanent. Nothing the teachers could do stemmed the tide. No child was left behind. We were united. Us against them. No wavering. Even under the feared rule of Sister Thomas. The Hairy Eyeball. If Ivan the Terrible had a sister, she would have been Sister Mary Thomas, a nun whose great regret in life was that she missed the Inquisition. The year 1961, the month September. The Berlin Wall had just been erected. John Kennedy was in the White House. Mr. Ed, a talking horse, was huge on TV, and Ray Charles was advising Jack to hit the road. None of that, however, mattered in the least to our seventh grade class sitting before a young nun with an attitude. We were just trying to survive. To call Sister Thomas unusual is like calling Michael Moore a liberal. It doesn't even come close. As I say these words, I am staring at my seventh grade photo. The girls are all sitting at their desks, Laura D. and Kathy M. anchoring the front row. The guys are standing in the back, lined up according to height. I am the second tallest, positioned between Greg, the aforementioned bear, and Kenny H. of pole-bashing fame. In the midst of the boys stands Sister Thomas, her black-and-white habit, the name for the nun uniform, shrouding all but her pale white face. Wearing black rim glasses and a very slight smile, the nun looks to be about 30 years old. Most of my classmates are smiling, but out of fear, not mirth. Everybody knew that Sister Thomas would see the class picture, and anybody defiling it would be subject to major unpleasantness. Unlike most teachers at St. Bridget's School, who towed the Catholic line but were somewhat gentle in doing so, Sister Thomas was a fanatic, a hellfire advocate who brooked no nonsense. Every morning she would order the class to take out the Baltimore Catechism, which listed Catholic teaching, and chant the following. A mortal sin is a deadly sin. A venial sin is a lesser sin. She would then define mortal and venial sins, putting a unique spin on the abominations. Mortal sins. Slow dancing with chests touching. Anything involving the tongue except talking and eating. Thinking about the above except talking and eating. Not going to Sunday Mass. Not telling every single sin to the priest in confession. Not praying to the Virgin Mary for forgiveness of sins. Not doing everything the church and your parents tell you to do. Not being sincere in your penance. Venial sins. Hitting your siblings. That's it. As you can see, mortal sins dominated, and drastic punishment, eternal damnation, was the price. Sister Thomas often told the touching story of two youngsters who had committed some kind of impurity. Tragically, before they could reach the confessional, they were killed in a car wreck. Sometimes a train demolished the car. Other times the car simply got wrecked with no explanation. Incredibly, Sister Thomas had tapped into popular culture with this storyline. A pop song called Teen Angel had become a big hit in February of 1960. Some will remember the song's refrain sung by a teenage boy holding the hand of his dead girlfriend who had just been annihilated by a train. Quote, Teen Angel, can you hear me? Teen Angel, can you see me? Are you somewhere up above? And am I still your own true love? Unquote. Good grief! The nun even had American Bandstand helping her. Even at age 12, a lot of the kids were deeply affected by Sister Thomas's harsh vision of life, but not Clement and not the bold, fresh guy. Often we would discuss the nun at recess, and most of the time the conversation was in the mortal sin category. The nun tortured us, but we would not let her prevail. Revenge was in the air. The conflict had been brewing for a while. Even before the 1961-62 school year had started, Sister Thomas knew Clem and Billy O'Reilly. She had heard the stories, and she relished the challenge. One time in the sixth grade, Clem and I were standing together at some school assembly, and she walked over. I'm looking forward to having you two gentlemen in my class next year. No more frightening words were ever spoken. Tragically, Sister Thomas got her wish, and the ensuing 9 months were the longest of my life. She had sonar hearing, picking up every whisper. The nun had a long list of infractions, with each bit of bad behavior earning its own specific punishment. Talking out of turn? A slap on the hand with a ruler. Talking back to sister, slap in the face, often hard. Being a wise guy in general, note home to parents, which had to be signed and brought back to her. This usually led to domestic punishment, at least for me. Sloppy appearance or work, after school detainment. Teasing girls Sister Thomas liked, trip to the principal, Sister Mary Thomasine, likely leading to after-school yard work, along with a severe scolding. The list of sanctions went on and on. Sister Thomas's seventh grade class wasn't an academic experience. It was a prisoner of war camp. But the absolute worst was her signature face-to-face confrontation. Staring down into your eyes, her eyeballs darted crazily back and forth. We called it the hairy eyeball, and it was truly eerie. Having that nun in your face was a terrifying experience rivaling a viewing of Not of This Earth. But revenge is a dish best served cold. Let her rip. A few times a year, the entire school body would participate in an activity. In the fifth grade, for example, we all marched down to the Westbury Movie Theater to see Jennifer Jones in the classic 1943 film, The Song of Bernadette, for which Miss Jones won an Academy Award. The thinking here was to use a Hollywood film to reinforce the Catholic faith. Since the movie jaunt got us out of math and English, the outing was fine with me. Unfortunately, all plans can go awry, and this one proved that beyond a reasonable doubt. The turn-of-the-century theater had an extensive balcony from whence water balloons were launched just as the Virgin Mary was appearing to Jennifer. Pandemonium ensued. The sanctity of the occasion was lost. Clem and I denied any part in the sacrilege. One of us was lying. In the spring semester of our seventh grade ordeal, Sister Thomas was given the honor of having her class perform a play for the entire school, parents included. I guess the administration believed that if anyone could control a student performance, it would be the taskmaster nun. But to quote my mom whenever I ask for something, we'll see. That year, 1962, was a tremendous one for pop music. The Beatles launched their first single in America, Love Me Do. Chubby Checker was twisting his butt off. And a real teen angel, Shelley Fabre of the Donna Reed Show, had a huge hit with a song called Johnny Angel. The girls in my class loved Shelley. The guys liked the new show called McHale's Navy. We were all twisting like insane people. My classmate Marlene named her new dog, Chubby. Against that cultural landscape, Sister Thomas selected Rip Van Winkle as the play her seventh grade class would perform. A classic tale, the Washington Irving short story involved a guy falling asleep for decades, largely because a mean woman was henpecking him. Many boys under Sister Thomas's tutelage immediately identified with Rip Van Winkle. Everyone in the class was assigned a part in the play except Clement and the bold fresh guy. The reasons were obvious, but Clem and I didn't much care. Until, that is, we learned that while our classmates rehearsed, we had to do busy work. We were ordered to fill out multiple pages in our Think and Do books, real name, and by the end of the day, turn them into Sister. An outrage while the rest of the class played, we had to work? Unthinkable. So we decided to plead our case. We went to Sister Thomas and politely asked to be included. Unbeknownst to us, this was exactly what the nun wanted. She believed that we would lose face if we whined about the exclusion. So she publicly mocked us, explaining to the kids that we had come hat in hand to her, asking for parts in the play. Rolling her weird eyes, she then put our request to a vote by the class. Should Billy and Clement be included in the play? What say you? Unanimously, the people spoke. Of course they should be included. How else would chaos be assured? Clement was given a very, and I mean very, small part as a rock in the Catskill Mountains. Along with several other urchins, he placed his face in a scenery cutout. In unison, he and all the other mountain rocks were supposed to bellow, "Poor Rip and poor Wolf." That dramatic line occurred immediately after Rip Van Winkle drank some kind of potion and dozed off. The mountain rocks were supposed to say the lines three times. Wolf, by the way, was Rip's dog. He didn't fall asleep, but the mountains felt sorry for him anyway. After that scene, about 10 seconds overall, the Catskill Mountains were never seen on stage again. Sister Thomas was taking no chances. Likewise, I was given a small part. I was a Dutchman. Along with five other guys, I was to pretend to roll a bowling ball and say, "The flagon, the wicked flagon." The wicked flagon was a large cup from which poor Rip had sipped. Apparently, the cup was wicked. Perhaps it had French kissed another cup. Anyway, it took me days, but I did learn my line. and Clement had his dialogue down as well. As performance day approached, Sister Thomas was feeling mighty good about things. She was actually jaunty, putting the finishing touches on everything Rip Van Winkle. Her two class pets had the lead roles, Richie as Rip and Diane as Dame Van Winkle, and all was right with the world. Then it happened, as fate had dictated. 2 days before airtime, Clement approached me on the playground. "Billy, we have to do something." I didn't like the sound of that at all, but Clem continued. "All the eighth graders will be watching, and I said we do something." "We, Clem, we? Are you insane? So what if the eighth graders are watching? So is every nun and priest in the parish, plus my mother and your mother." "Yeah, it'll be great." "What'll be great?" "When we wreck the play." For the first time, I saw Clement clearly, even though I'd known him since he was 5 years old. He was truly demented. By the seventh grade, Clem was already shaving a couple of times a week, and his outlook on life was far beyond that of the average 12-year-old. On that spring day, more than 45 years ago, I stared hard at my pal, and the gleam in his eye said it all. "I don't care." "Clem, I don't want to die. I can't wreck the play." To this day, I can still remember the sadness that crossed Clement's face. His compadre was chicken, his pal a wuss. He silently shook his head and walked away. For a second, I felt terrible. Then I regained what little sense I had. To sabotage Sister Thomas's play was a truly desperate act. There would be no escaping the inevitable retribution certain to swiftly follow. Why didn't we just lie down on the Northern State Parkway? To my discredit, I did not try to talk Clement out of his insanity, perhaps because a large part of me wanted to see Sister Thomas humiliated. But I knew Clem was going to get hurt. There was no doubt. Soon the day arrived and the auditorium was packed. From backstage, we peered out at the assemblage. Parents, teachers, students, even the parish pastor, Father Code. This was big. Somewhere in the crowd sat my mother. No way my father was going to sit through Rip Van Winkle unless he had a number of flagons filled with refreshment, and that was not happening. But Mom was actually looking forward to seeing her son in his dopey Dutchman outfit. Moms are amazing. No question but that Sister Thomas thought she was Steven Spielberg. She ran from one kid to the next, making sure the costumes were fitted correctly and nobody was throwing up. We were all nervous, everybody that is, except Clement. He sat serenely backstage, but I knew that look. Wayne was really scared. Dressed in a shabby canine outfit, he was playing Rip's dog, Wolf, and had to crawl around following the leading man, Richie. Even though Wayne had no lines, he was petrified. Clement noticed Wayne, too, and then I noticed Clem noticing Wayne. Uh-oh, I remember thinking that somehow this was not going to turn out all that well for Wayne. The curtain rose, and for the first few minutes, everything went swell. Sister Thomas sat to the right of the stage, following the script on her clipboard. Most of the kids were stage left. Nobody really wanted to hang close to the notorious nun. The first sign of trouble came when Rip drank from the flagon and slumped to the ground. Somehow, he landed on Wayne's paws, causing his faithful pet to fall down as well. Big laughs from the crowd. Cue the mountain rocks. Remember, they were supposed to say, in unison, "Poor Rip and poor Wolf." But one voice bellowed above the rest, completely out of sync. Does the name Clement mean anything? While the other rocks wailed, "Poor Wolf," Clem drowned them out by screaming, "And Rip is poor, too! He doesn't have any money. That isn't fair." Massive laugh from the eighth graders. Sister Thomas's face turned Alabama crimson. Those eyes darted all over the place, like some crazy kind of pinball game. As the curtain fell for a scene change, Clement bolted. I later learned he fled to the sanctuary of the boys' bathroom. I actually prayed to St. Michael the Archangel for Clem. I hoped that prank was it, that he established his eighth-grade cred, and the play would conclude without further chaos. My scene came next, but I don't remember any of it. My mother says I did fine, and she could hear me call the flagon wicked, but it's all a blur to me. However, the play's climax remains crystal clear in my mind. I can actually see it in slow motion. After Rip comes back from his snooze and all is well in town, the main characters gather for a bow. but Wayne is not on stage. Instead, Clement is inside the dog costume and is furiously biting Richie on the leg. Rich frantically tries to get away, but Clem hangs on, actually sinking his teeth into the poor kid. There's yelling, scuffling, pandemonium. Curtain. Clement was suspended for 2 weeks, which was pretty much the rest of the term. There was talk of expulsion, but his mother, a Daily Mass communicant, threw herself on the mercy of the court. Clem was allowed to return for a hilarious eighth grade ride, but I'll save that for another book. After the play debacle, Sister Thomas said very little to the class. With only a couple of weeks left in the school year, she gave us our exams and prayed many, many rosaries. Nobody got whacked with the ruler during those final days, even though we constantly discussed a forbidden topic, the hysteria of the performance. Wayne told me that Clement simply took him out. Wayne was a little guy and Clem was strong, so the costume hijack was accomplished in seconds. I asked Wayne if Clem had said anything. Wayne said, yeah, give me the dog suit. Okay. Yeah, I'm keeping the faith. Billy Joel understands the Long Island experience because he lived it, and I'll submit to you that much of what I witnessed as a child remains indelible. I remember nearly everything about St. Bridget's School. Those were great times, and they solidified my relationship with Catholicism because everything was tied in together. Memorable classmates, coming of age, a charitable philosophy, and a sense that life has a purpose if you live it with generosity. I may have been in the dumb row, but eventually I figured it all out. After graduation the following year, my father forced me to go to a strict Catholic high school, Chaminade, where my religious education continued. He made the right call. Even though I wanted to go to the public school with my thug friends, my dad understood that I needed continual structure and discipline. To this day, Chaminade leads the league in that. There's no doubt that 12 years of blending academics with spiritual teaching forge my point of view today. As I've mentioned in Chapter 3, my arrival at Marist College in the fall of 1967 coincided with a growing secularization of that traditionally Catholic institution. But even as the liberated late 60s blew across campus, I still went to church. On some Sunday mornings, there were about five students staring at the chaplain, a kindly man named Father Leo Gallant. I continued to go to Mass because I actually liked the spiritual timeout. Leaving the chaotic college world for a while, I enjoyed getting into another dimension, with apologies to Rod Serling. Mass time allowed me to think and figure out right from wrong. In those years, believe me, that wasn't all that easy. To this day, I still go to Sunday Mass. Often it's boring. Many times the priest goes on far too long about the mustard seed. Hey, Father, those of us showing up on Sunday have got that down, okay? Fallow ground, not good. Let's advance the discussion, shall we? In helping me to determine right from wrong, good from evil, and trying to correct injustice, my Catholic faith is invaluable. In public and on TV and radio, I usually keep my religion to myself because I have a secular job. I'm a journalist, not an evangelist. But if somebody brings up the subject, I tell him or her what I just told you. Religion has been a very positive thing in my life. Without it, I would never have been motivated to expose bad guys and celebrate heroism. Most media people are self-interested and cautious. But I see my job as much more than a big paycheck and a good table at the bistro du jour. I am on a mission, and it all started in the first grade. Much later in life, after I traveled the world as a reporter and witnessed awful things, the final piece of the Catholic puzzle fell into place. Like many people, I often wondered how a just God, that is, the Trinity, Jesus' Father and the Holy Spirit, could allow so much pain in the universe. A higher power, the Creator, could certainly stop the madness. The answer to that vexing question lies in the concept of free will. Christianity teaches that free will defines a human being, separates us from the animals. Human beings have the power to choose which actions to take. Lions do not have that ability. They act on instinct. Thus, the world of man is a constant struggle between good and evil, and what we choose defines us. The essence of Christianity and most other theologies is embracing good and rejecting evil. If there were no evil presence in the world, then there could be no choice. That's why bad stuff has been on display from the beginning of time. The end game, of course, is to earn God's reward in the afterlife by rejecting evil. And in Catholicism and other Christian religions, the actions of Jesus demonstrate how to do that. It all makes perfect sense to me. The Christian ethic defines the decisions I make, both personal and professional. But Sister Thomas was right about one thing. I could be a lot better at this. Finally, my pal Clement died young. I kept up with him through college, and he remained a vibrant spirit. But he always had health problems, and eventually they caught up with him. I believe he's in heaven. Jesus could never pass on those laughs. Chapter 6, Saving the World. Don't know much about history, don't know much biology. Sam Cooke, Wonderful World. God does have a sense of humor, no question. After watching me terrorize teachers for years, the Almighty dropped a teaching job right into my lap. And you say you don't believe? The year was 1971, the month September, and every weekday morning at exactly 6:30 a.m., Rod Stewart's voice would blare from my clock radio. "Wake up, Maggie, I think I've got something to say to you. It's late September, and I really should be back at school." Well, I was back at school, all right. Specifically, Monsignor Edward Pace High School, located in the shabby, tough Florida town of Opa-locka, just north of Miami. To this day, it consistently scores among the highest rates of violent crime in the USA. This was not the Villages, if you know what I'm saying. The job happened because the powers that were at Pace had a relationship with Marist College and were looking for cheap labor. That would be me. Along with my trusty college roommate, Joe Rubino, I signed on to teach English for less than $5,000. Beginning of story. Teaching held a good amount of appeal to me. Back in the Woodstock days, I felt I should do something worthwhile with my life. I wanted to help folks. It never occurred to me to sell stocks or insurance. That would be working for the man. While I saw nothing particularly wrong with working for the man, I knew my father had not benefited from doing that, and again, I wanted to help improve society. Really. Plus, there was the strong appeal of South Florida. Rubino and I had done the spring break thing during our senior year, hunting for Connie Francis on the beaches of Fort Lauderdale. We never did find Connie, but there were many, many Connie wannabes on display. All I'll say is this. After I'd spent 3 years in Poughkeepsie, New York, the sun surf and female denizens of South Florida looked mighty fine indeed. So we packed up our gear and headed south. The first sign of trouble was our assigned accommodations. Because we were working for slave wages, the principal at Pace set us up with a low-rent apartment near the school. "You guys are going to like this," he told me on the phone. "Convenient to everything. And there's a pool." By convenient to everything, I guess the guy meant to the half-dozen drug dealers who lived in the complex. If you were after weed or cocaine, these accommodations were indeed convenient. The pool was there as advertised, but a rusty refrigerator had taken up residence at the bottom of it. This was not exactly Surfside 6. We lasted less than 30 minutes in our new digs. Checking out of the horror apartment complex, we quickly found alternative housing with fewer active felons on the premises. But incredibly, the principal was rather put off that we had exited his recommended lodgings. His annoyance should have signaled me that we would not be dealing with a rational guy at the school helm, but it went over my head at the time. "Hey, Teach, what's up? As I talk to you, I am looking at myself in the 1972 edition of The Torch, the Pace High School yearbook. There I am, sitting in front of a class, hair covering my ears, pork chop sideburns, and a firm, steely look. I was no Sister Thomas, but believe the photo. I brooked no nonsense. If a kid clowned around, he or she was sharply warned. Second time, an appropriate sanction was swiftly delivered to the miscreant. Early on, I was tested, as most young teachers are. In my case, I was just 21 years old when I began teaching, and one of my assigned classes was senior English. That meant that most of my students were 17 and 18 years old. Do the math. One day, a blonde girl called me Bill in front of the class. This was against school rules, since all teachers were to be addressed as Mr., Mrs., or Miss. In my mind, the girl had intentionally misbehaved for two reasons. Attention, and the thrill of it all. I had prepared myself for this. Before the school year had started, I mapped out a game plan to handle what was sure to be some challenging behavior. I was the new young teacher on campus. Even in my callow youth, I knew boundaries would have to be quickly established or chaos would ensue. Understanding that discipline is useless without respect, I think I got that from Sidney Poitier in To Sir with Love, I coolly appraised the young girl who had just used my given name. Miss Jones, an alias, why don't you explain to the class why you addressed me by my first name when you know that's a breach of etiquette? I kept my voice calm but authoritative. The breach of etiquette line threw her. I don't know, she replied. So let me get this straight, Miss Jones. You decide to break school rules, taking away time from the class, and you don't know why? Am I understanding you? Panic swept across the girl's face, which was deeply reddening. Every kid in the class was staring at her. What started as an attempt to diminish me, the inexperienced teacher, had suddenly gone horribly wrong. She sat there mute. Okay, Miss Jones, here's what we're going to do, I said sharply. You are going to write a 500-word composition explaining your actions here today. This will be due tomorrow. If you behave yourself, I'll keep your work private. If you do not, I will read it to the class. Are we clear? Yes, Mr. O'Reilly. Good. And that was it. Word of Miss Jones's smackdown spread throughout the Pace campus like fire ants on spilled maple syrup. After that, I had little trouble in the classroom. Every student in the school immediately understood that when Mr. O was involved, humiliation might be just one stupid comment away. You see, I understood something many adults never get. The worst thing you can do to a dopey teenager is to embarrass him or her in front of their peers. You can yell and scream at kids all day long and accomplish nothing. But holding students accountable for their actions publicly has a major inhibiting effect. Not too many kids, or adults for that matter, want to become an object of public derision. One caveat here. This doesn't work on the psycho kids. However, Catholic schools tend to weed them out pretty fast and send them on their way. Now, there's no question that I had damaged Miss Jones's self-esteem, and today, the enlightened educators who are embedded in the American education system would probably chastise me for the insensitivity. But listen up. I don't care. In the 2 years I taught at Pace, my methods were effective with hundreds of students, most of whom actually learned some things. Meanwhile, many of the other teachers at Pace presided over undisciplined classroom environments that wasted time and accomplished little. I actually cared whether my students were learning. That's why I allowed Rod Stewart's raspy voice to disturb my slumber so early in the morning. I believed it was my responsibility to create an atmosphere where kids could learn important things without disruption. If a teacher can't or won't do that, the students get hosed. Now, I realize that might sound self-righteous, but that's how I saw it. I was getting paid to do a job, and no defiant kid was going to stop me, period. Even so, I didn't want to damage any kid. Shortly after her indiscretion, I spoke with Miss Jones privately. She cried, and I felt bad. But I explained that what she did was unacceptable, and if she continued that kind of behavior, her life would be the worse for it. Did she get the message? I'd love to tell you that the incident changed her life, and she went on to do great things. But the truth is, I don't know how Miss Jones turned out. She was a strange kid. Something was definitely bothering her, and she wasn't the confiding type, at least not to me. Life isn't Sidney Poitier winning over Lulu and the other British toughies on the big screen. Still, never again did Miss Jones or any other student disrupt that senior English class. And by the end of the school year, most of those people scored well on the exam I gave them, and trust me, the test was not easy. The majority of Pace High students came from working-class homes with parents who sacrificed to pay private school tuition. Ethnically, it broke down this way: 50% Hispanic, 40% white, 10% black. Cubans dominated the campus. I liked them from the jump. Most were hardworking, respectful, and grateful to America for saving them from Castro. In fact, I had more trouble with the Pace faculty than I did with the kids. Hard to believe, I know. By now, you have probably picked up that I have a small problem with authority, except when I am it. Then authority is okay. Many of the faculty administrators at Pace were small-picture people. That is, they were clueless about what the kids were doing and thinking, and concentrated on enforcing picayune and largely meaningless rules. For example, some faculty members actually busy themselves measuring the skirts of the girls. Each female student was required to wear a standardized sky blue colored uniform. However, some of the young ladies were hiking up hemlines in an apparent attempt to imitate Goldie Hawn. Some teachers used rulers to measure the proper skirt length. It was almost surreal. Meanwhile, a number of the girls left the school in a family way, if you know what I mean. But there was little talk of dealing with that or the substance abuse occurring on the campus. Since most students at Pace had little money, glue was the substance of choice that year. Cretans would enter the bathroom stalls, smear it on rags, and inhale. Glassy-eyed, they'd stagger into the classroom. I cornered one of the leaders of the rag brigade, a skinny wise guy, and basically told him that if he didn't knock it off, I would hunt him down off school property and we'd discuss things. Apparently, he got the message, and the cheap high crowd toned it down. By the way, I would have hunted him down. Of course, the principal, a corpulent, middle-aged Catholic brother, and most of the teachers had no idea that glue was in vogue. No, they were too busy measuring the skirts of the girls. It was tough, but I ignored most of the insane faculty-driven minutiae because there was nothing I could do about it. The principal and his disciples had their agenda, and it wasn't going to change because some wise guy New York teacher thought it was nuts. But one time, I did listen to the Isley brothers and decided to fight the power. By the way, that strategy rarely turns out well. Do not try this at work. I've told some parts of the following story before, but in a different context. Here, the point is that we in America waste far too much time endlessly discussing stupid stuff. If something is wrong, fix it. Don't discuss it to death. As actor Eli Wallach stated in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, when you have to shoot, shoot. Don't talk. As in many southern states, high school football is big in Florida. On late summer and fall Friday evenings, thousands of kids attend games and do what many kids do in the dark, attempt to misbehave. There's the usual drinking and smoking and cursing out the opposition, the kind of stuff that's been going on for generations. But at Pace, as our Spartans took the field in red and gold uniforms, there was another huge problem. Hot pants, the garment. Even at these night games, the average temperature in Miami that year was about 88 degrees with humidity at the suicide level. I mean, it was brutal. So the kids dressed accordingly. That is, they wore very little. The attire situation caused fear and loathing among the faculty at Pace, and I saw their point. Wearing halters and short shorts, some of the girls looked like Carmen Electra, not exactly the image of a Catholic high school, with all due respect to Miss Electra. Because the bold, fresh guy has always been a simple man, my solution to the problem was exceedingly simple. Tell the girls that halters and hot pants were banned at all school events, and if they violated the rule, they would be punished. If they didn't like it, tough. Go roller skating. Simple, right? Easily done. But no, as the late John Belushi was fond of saying on Saturday Night Live, the hot pants deal had to be discussed and debated and parsed at faculty meetings over and over again. It was insane. Finally, I reached critical mass. A woman teacher named Isabella, alias, stood up and said, "I want to ask the faculty to tell us what is appropriate attire at a foosball game." Immediately, my hand shot up and my roommate Joe Rubino put his head in his hands, something he had practiced quite often. "Yes, Mr. O'Reilly." I slowly got to my feet and said, "I believe, Isabella, that appropriate football game attire is a helmet, spiked shoes, padded shoulders and thighs, and tight pants to keep the pants secured." Silence. Then a few muffled guffaws. The principal shot me a look that would have made Hannibal Lecter envious. Everybody knew I had mocked the faculty meeting. I was off the reservation. The following day, I addressed the hot pants issue in all my classes, and my message was sage and pithy. I simply stated that any girl who dressed like a cheap tart was foolish and would lose the respect of boys, especially decent guys. I also told the students that boys routinely mocked girls they thought were easy and had done so since guys were invented. No further lecture was necessary, and there were no threats. I simply asked if anyone had any questions, and nobody did. Once again, word whipped around the campus. The hot pants mania subsided as few teenage girls want to be mocked by teenage boys. Another victory for the home team, right? Not so fast. Life is full of unintended consequences, and boy, did I make enemies among the faculty. Not that I cared at the time, I didn't. I liked most of my students, but thought the faculty, by and large, were simpletons. I was wrong. Looking back, I was the narrow-minded person because my arrogance was based on ignorance. The truth is that most of the teachers at Pace were good people. They were just scared to make waves. They needed the job. Not so different from my father. During my 2 years teaching high school, I learned an enormous amount about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But one lesson stands above all the others. You can't save everyone. You can give people opportunities, you can try to help them, but some will not succeed for a variety of reasons. Once in a while, I look back at the Pace yearbook and see the kids who washed out in life. Could I have done something different to help them? Perhaps. But I tried as hard as I knew how, and have subsequently learned that some human beings simply cannot be saved. It's just life in the real lane. This insight has shaped my political beliefs and my policy analysis. As we discussed in Chapter 2, I am big on self-reliance and not enthusiastic about the nanny state. I strongly believe that in America, each individual succeeds by understanding obligations and doing what is necessary to fulfill them. The government cannot do it for us, cannot drag us through life's daily challenges, making sure we'll all be okay. Those who promise that are charlatans. To repeat what I said earlier, if you rely on big government, you'll pay big. That separates me from someone like Nancy Pelosi, for example, who fervently believes that a huge federal presence can bring prosperity to disadvantaged people and just about everybody else. Speaker Pelosi fervently wants high taxes, a redistribution of wealth through said taxation, and a general welfare system that provides cradle-to-grave entitlements like they have in Holland. Maybe the speaker wants that because she herself is a very wealthy woman, raised in extremely comfortable surroundings. Maybe she feels some guilt over having that kind of life when others don't. Liberal guilt has been known to happen. Anyway, I worked awfully hard at Pace trying to wise kids up and succeeded in many cases, but obviously not all. Some kids were so emotionally damaged by the time they got to my class that no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't motivate them to be responsible. Their plight usually mirrored that of their parents. Most of the slackers had big trouble at home. That kind of scenario is one of the most vexing problems facing America. The government cannot legislate decent parenting. Any clown can have a child. There are no tests, standards, or guidelines for parents unless they violate the child abuse or neglect laws. Therefore, some children will be so traumatized by their upbringing that they will cause society big problems that we all pay for, sometimes with our lives. So what does society do? Again, it all comes back to free will that I believe we all have. Even though a child has it rough, there will come a time when he or she, like all other human beings, is faced with a clear choice: either become a productive citizen or become a problem. Almost every violent criminal I've ever spoken with had a terrible childhood. But if society, out of some misguided compassion, does not hold them accountable for harming others, the result is anarchy. As you know, some well-intentioned liberals disagree, arguing for lenient sentences and rehabilitation, even for heinous child rapists. But that point of view is both dangerous and unfair to both innocent kids and law-abiding adults. The government's first obligation is to protect its citizens, not sympathize with those who would harm them. One student at Pace High School committed a murder. I knew the kid. He had a terrible facial complexion and was subject to bullying beyond belief. Socially, the boy was almost totally isolated. You can imagine the anger the kid held inside himself. But he killed somebody. That's irreversible. No matter what the personality profile, society cannot allow troubled people to inflict harm on others. Period. That philosophy was shaped by my teaching experience. I was a disciplinarian, as you've seen. But fair. Any student could appeal his or her punishment. I'd listen and sometimes adjust the sanction. I did that because I remembered Brother Lawrence. Back in my own high school days, there was class warfare in the hallways of Chaminade, a high-powered all-boy Catholic school in Mineola, New York. On one side of the aisle were the working-class guys like me. On the other, the rich kids from affluent neighborhoods like Garden City and Locust Valley. Among Chaminade's host of strict rules was a requirement that students wear jackets and ties every day. As you are now aware, my father was not exactly Oleg Cassini. My closet held a couple of cheap sports coats and a few clip-on ties. But many of the rich guys were decked out in cashmere sports jackets and nifty blue blazers from Brooks Brothers. I mean, some Chaminade guys even talked about clothes. Nobody in Levittown did that. Anyway, the rich guys looked swell, and the working-class guys looked like Rodney Dangerfield, and that was that. Or not. One day, two Garden City guys, looking for trouble, approached me and pulled off my clip-on tie. Being the intellectual that I am, I immediately punched one guy in the head and slammed the other guy hard against a locker, causing a big noise. Showing alarming speed, Brother Lawrence was on me, slamming me against another locker. "Hey, brother, those two started it," I wailed. "No fighting in school, O'Reilly. 3 days detention," the brother snapped. "What about them?" I asked, an edge to my voice. "I'll deal with them," the brother said. "That doesn't concern you." Doesn't concern me? Good grief. But that was Chaminade back in 1966. The rich guys got preference. The working class guys got detention. I did my time, but never forgot the incident. So it was that kind of sensibility that I brought to my own high school classroom. If a kid thought he was getting hosed, I'd listen. But BS walked in my sphere of influence, and every kid at Pace High knew it. Looking back, I really didn't have to do much in the discipline area. Once the tone was set, most of my classes went smoothly. In fact, kids were clamoring to get into my courses. At the start of the second semester of my first year, hundreds of juniors and seniors signed up for my contemporary problems class, all of them knowing that the workload would be fairly heavy. However, as I mentioned, there is an opposing point of view, and the discipline I brought to teaching does not sit well with some liberal people. Dr. Wayne Dyer, for example, has sold millions of books advising folks on how to deal with life in a rather holistic way. Writing in the Bottom Line Personal magazine, Dyer had this to say about teaching. Quote, "Show faith in a person's ability to make right decisions, and they will generally make them. Education researchers have found that the classrooms of authoritarian teachers tend to descend into chaos as soon as a teacher steps outside. The classrooms of teachers who trust their students will do the right thing and usually continue to run smoothly even without the teacher." Unquote. Dr. Dyer doesn't cite any research he uses to make that dubious claim, but clearly the man has never read Lord of the Flies or figured out that it is far easier to do your own thing than to do the discipline thing. Put another way, it's more fun to be bad than good, more pleasurable to relax than work. Your thoughts, Dr. Dyer. History clearly demonstrates that without structure and accountability, human beings have a tough time staying on the rails. And children must be taught this over and over again. An effective person must incorporate discipline into his or her life, and a just society must demand responsibility from its citizens. I learned that beyond a reasonable doubt while teaching at Pace High, and have passed it on ever since. One more story, and I'll dedicate it to Dr. Wayne. Pace High was generally a dumpy place, two-story classroom buildings, very few amenities. But during my time at Pace, a nice new gymnasium was built, and the Bishop of Miami was coming to bless it. The kids didn't care about the ritual, but it was a chance to miss some classes, so they were jazzed. In anticipation of the event, an assembly was called to go over what the ceremony would entail. Hundreds of kids sat in the brand new stands, completely ignoring the principal, who was trying to impose some kind of order so directions could be given for the blessing. Becoming increasingly frustrated, the principal stepped to the microphone and sternly demanded silence. The noise got even louder, the laughter and mocking almost deafening. This went on for about 3 minutes, and then, as with the hot pants discussion, I ran out of patience. Armed with my trusty clipboard and pen, I stepped onto the gym floor, glared at the chattering throng, and began writing down names. Almost immediately, the noise began to diminish. As I scanned the crowd, there were fewer and fewer comedians performing. I continued to stare hard at the students. They shut up. Then I stepped back and gestured to the principal. Of course, this completely showed the guy up, and he knew it. But once again, the lesson was there for all to see. Without consequences, kids will go wild. Dr. Wayne Dyer may not know that, but I do. By the way, I didn't do anything to the kids who were mocking the principal because I had made my point. But once again, I had alienated the powers that be in the process. Can you say recurring theme? The months flew by at pace, and every day I learned something new about human nature, child development, and America in general. I was the educator, but I was definitely getting an education as well. Take the debate about more money for schools. Every time I hear some pinhead politician grandstand about the issue, I seethe. In most places, there are plenty of school resources, and if there aren't, chances are the local school board is stealing. The feds are spending record amounts on education, and school-directed property taxes in many places are obscene. I taught in a relatively poor school. The books were there, and to do my job, I didn't need anything else beside a working air conditioner. My third-grade teacher, Sister Lorana, had 60 kids in her class, and every one of them could read, write, and do math by the age of 8. Give me a break. Teaching is about presentation and accountability. Money and resources are secondary. The U.S. public school education system has plenty of cash. What it lacks are competent, courageous administrators and creative teachers. Yes, better salaries might attract better people, but teaching is a calling, not a business. Teaching in South Florida for those 2 years remains a highlight of my life. Yeah, money was tight. To get extra funds, I got a second job as a bouncer in the rec bar at the Castaways Hotel on the northern end of Miami Beach. Actually, I didn't do much bouncing. My job was to make sure the house band, Tommy Strand and the Upper Hand, didn't commit any on-premises felonies, as drugs and underage girls were known to make appearances in the saloon. To this day, I know every word to Aretha Franklin's hit Chain of Fools, thanks to Tommy Strand, who sang it every Saturday night. Those years were hot in South Florida. The Miami Dolphins made it to the Super Bowl in both 72 and 73 and won it in the latter year, going 17-0, a record that still stands. And get this, Pace High School was located right next to the Dolphins training facility at St. Thomas University. One day, I brazenly sneaked into a Don Shula press conference and actually asked the coach a stupid question. He looked at me like I had spilled ketchup on his shirt. But after 2 enjoyable years at Pace, it was time for a change. The administration and I had had enough of each other, so I hit the road. After being accepted by Boston University to study for a master's degree in broadcast journalism, I left South Florida, my roommate Joe, and scores of other friends. I had mixed feelings about the move. I enjoyed seeing my students learn and become more sophisticated in their world outlook, but I was restless and wanted a bigger stage than a high school classroom. It was time to go. But before I left Pace, a student dropped the following note in my mailbox. Mr. O, although this year was pretty bad for me, there was one thing that made up for it. I was lucky enough to have a teacher who cared enough to not only teach the required subject, but also teach me about life and awareness of others and myself. I am grateful for having known you. As any teacher will tell you, that's what it's all about. Chapter 7, Standing Your Ground. Because I love that dirty water. Oh, Boston, you're my home. The Standells, dirty water. To walk down Boston's Commonwealth Avenue in the autumn of 1973 was to witness history unfolding. Hippies, college kids, boozeheads, townies, and actual working people, blue-collar to the highest white shoe professions, all intermingled daily. In the midst of this diversity, they probably shared only one interest in common, and it was a really big deal. President Richard Nixon, long known as Tricky Dick, was in huge trouble. He might even go to prison. People talked about little else. For a year, Washington Post investigative reporters Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward, relatively unknown at the time, had been chasing down leads in the Watergate story. Now, thanks largely to them, Nixon was on the ropes. As you can imagine, all of us journalism students at Boston University's School of Public Communications closely followed every twist and turn. Almost every day, there were new and exciting stories. October 10th, Vice President Spiro Agnew quits. Days later, he's indicted for federal income tax evasion. He would subsequently plead no contest and be convicted. October 20th. Nixon orders Attorney General Elliot Richardson to fire Watergate Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox, who was aggressively challenging Nixon's dodges. Richardson refuses. Nixon fires him and his deputy, William Ruckelshaus. Robert Bork takes over and fires Cox. All hell is breaking loose around the country after this so-called Saturday night massacre. Impeachment talk heats up, and to think just a year earlier, Nixon had defeated South Dakota Senator George McGovern in a national landslide. Now his presidency was a shambles. He would resign the following August. There simply was no better time to be studying journalism in America. I really lucked out. The divisive Vietnam War and ensuing protests had dramatically changed the country, leading to the Age of Aquarius, where social liberalism blossomed. For example, in 1973, the Supreme Court, by a vote of 7-2, affirmed Roe v. Wade as the law of the land. For the first time, abortion was legal all across the USA. That never would have happened had the country not moved to the left so quickly. But while a fetus could now be destroyed in the womb, convicted killers had been granted a reprieve, as the Supremes a year earlier had ruled the death penalty unconstitutional. The case Furman v. Georgia was a closely decided 5-4 vote. And as America continued its liberal march, there I was, your budding bold fresh correspondent, right smack dab in the middle of it. But as they say, let the peace-love buyer beware. As the Power to the People brigades reached the height of their influence, self-indulgence and arrogance were bringing many flower children crashing down. Crazy nonsense was all over the place. Violent Black Panthers were celebrated as good guys, while brave U.S. service people fighting for their country were labeled villains. Some awful things were going down, as Buffalo Springfield sang. For me, the Beatles best summed up the hazy Age of Aquarius atmosphere when they sang. Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. That would be from Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, the song I mentioned in Chapter 1. Unfortunately, LSD and other drugs were everywhere at BU. Getting stoned was routine. Everybody was doing it. Everybody, that is, except me. Continuing my anti-drug posture, I adopted the same mode of behavior I had at Marist, total abstention from substances. By now, I actually hated drugs, because a couple of my Levittown friends had become hardcore addicts, and I witnessed their degeneration up close and personal. I saw them break the hearts of their mothers. I saw them steal from their fathers and friends. I witnessed their complete debasement and ultimately watched as they destroyed themselves. There was nothing I could do. One died in his 30s, the other went to prison. Drinking, too, I couldn't stand it. At a high school party, I watched as inebriated kids vomited all over my friend's house. Miles's parents had gone to Florida and foolishly left the 18-year-old in charge. Those bombed kids caused thousands of dollars of damage to the place, and they didn't care a whit. Why? Because they were drunk out of their minds. That's why. As I've said before, I have never been intoxicated or taken any illegal drug, including marijuana. Now, I know some people think this is weird, but I am proud of it. I made a decision. I did not want to be under the influence of anything other than my own dubious personality. Ever. So I stood my ground at Boston University and lost some social opportunities because of my anti-drug position. So be it. I still had a great time, and I remember all of it. And I never hurt anyone or destroyed anything while under the influence. I never vomited in the bushes or drove drunk. Good for me. Still, I was often alone that year. While strobe lights streaked and bongs stoked up, I went to the movies. American Graffiti was my favorite. Where were you in 1962? Well, I was attending St. Bridget's School, learning it wasn't all about me. That's where I was. Truth be told, I liked my country better pre-Vietnam. It was more fun. The Aquarius deal was too confusing. I mean, John Lennon thought he was a walrus? What was that all about? Grace Slick wanted us to feed our heads? Great. But what happens when you overdose, Grace? Do you feel bad because you encourage drug use? And Jim Morrison wanted to light our fires. Remember that great song? Morrison wound up dead in a bathtub at age 27. Where was Leslie Gore when I needed her? Looking back, I remember being home from school in the summer of 73 and having a very pretty girl from Huntington, Long Island, invite me to a party. As soon as we arrived, a giant cloud of pot smoke hit us right between the eyes. "Far out," she said. "Let's get out," I answered. one of us departed. Confronting hatred. Upon reflection, I count my stand against the temptations of the time as another major turning point in my life. Instead of chasing Jefferson Airplane's white rabbit, I concentrated on pursuing a career. While some other BU students devolved into being dazed and confused on a daily basis, I was focused and determined. I was going to be the next Woodward or Bernstein, whichever one was better looking. By the way, as with my religious beliefs, I did not openly criticize those who took up the stoned life unless they were very close to me. Then I try to persuade them back to sobriety. And to this day, I don't lecture people about their personal behavior unless it harms another person. I have too much on my karmic rap sheet to be throwing stones at anyone else. Besides, people like Hunter S. Thompson made a good living in journalism actually using chemicals as a prop. But as you may know, Thompson eventually killed himself, so maybe he's not a great example. Anyway, as 1974 unfolded, the dramatic action continued. President Ford eventually pardoned Nixon, probably dooming his own re-election chances. Ford also pardoned the Vietnam draft dodgers. One of them, Muhammad Ali, beat the fearsome George Foreman in a huge Africa prize fight. Happy Days debuted on TV, and Blazing Saddles was a hit at the movies. But on the ground in Boston, it was all about race and busing. Embracing the liberal social policies of the day, a federal judge named Arthur Garrity had ordered South Boston High School to be integrated. To achieve that end, it was decided that scores of black students